This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Back in 2002, 18-year-old Andre McCollins was living at the Judge Rotenberg Center in Canton, Massachusetts. It's a facility for people with intellectual or psychiatric disabilities. Andre has developmental disabilities, and growing up, when he got upset, he would sometimes kick or hit or break things. That's according to Andre's mom, Cheryl. She told New York Magazine that Andre had to be hospitalized at least 3 times as a child for his uncontrollable behavior. So when Cheryl moved Andre to the Rotenberg Center, staff told her about an electric shock device that they sometimes used to treat residents. Cheryl hoped it would help with his aggression.
I thought human treatment and logic was going to be used for therapy. I thought it was a school to help children with special needs. And the way they explained the procedure to me, that this device would do that.
So Cheryl gave her approval to use the device. So did a local court. Andre wore the device. It's a backpack with electrodes attached to his arms and legs. And when he did something staff thought he should not, a worker could press a button and give him a 2-second electric shock. One day, a staff member told Andre to take off his jacket. When Andre didn't move, the worker shocked him. When Andre tried to crawl under his desk, staff grabbed him and wrestled him to the floor. He was ultimately tied face down to a restraining board and shocked 31 times. Video of this incident became public 10 years later.
Stop for real.
Many disability rights advocates were outraged. And since the video surfaced, they've spent years calling for these shock devices to be banned.
Protesters gathered outside the Judge Rotenberg Center in Canton this afternoon, calling on the school to stop what they say is torture.
Absolutely, this is torture. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture has said it is torture.
That's protester Olivia Richard speaking to Boston television station WCVB in 2018. But not all parents are opposed to the devices. Sharon Wood told CBS News that the treatment had been hugely beneficial for her son Joshua, who has autism and occasionally aggressive behavior he cannot control.
The change in him was almost instantaneous, and he has never worn a helmet since in his car for transportation. He has not been restrained one time since. You see him here, he looks like one of the healthiest kids you would ever see, and he's smiling. But every now and then when he gets these impulses that he can't control, which aren't very often, he either has a GED on him to remind him, I can't do that, or he'll get the 2-second bee sting, which interrupts the process in his brain.
A lawyer for the Judge Rotenberg Center, or JRC, Michael Famia, told CNN it's a last resort for many parents.
The schools that say they don't use it and that treat the tough kids, the very difficult behavioral disordered students that they can't treat without the aversives, they come to JRC. They are discharged from those programs and they are sent to JRC. So JRC is treating the most difficult cases of behavior disorders in the nation.
But in 2020, the United States Food and Drug Administration banned the electrical stimulation devices for use in treating injurious or aggressive behavior. The agency said the devices, quote, present an unreasonable and substantial risk of illness or injury that cannot be corrected or eliminated through new or updated device labeling, end quote. This was a rare step because the FDA almost never bans medical devices. The JRC and a group of parents sued FDA, saying it did not have the authority to ban the electrical shock device for one specific use. And they argued the agency either had to ban the device totally or not at all. The parents won, and the devices are back in use. Now, we're telling you this story because it is very important background for the issue that we're going to grapple with today. Because recently, Congress quietly expanded the FDA's authority. Tucked into the $1.7 trillion spending bill Congress passed in December are 19 lines of language that authorizes FDA to ban medical devices for some off-label uses. Not just those electrical stimulation devices that were used at the Judge Rotenberg Center, but any medical device. Now, some say this is a step in the right direction, that FDA should have authority to regulate how medical devices are used. But others worry that the new authority will let the FDA interfere with the doctor-patient relationship, and that it could be the first step down a slippery slope where FDA may be able to extend its authority to prohibit off-label use of, say, prescription drugs, which can constitute 1 in 5 prescriptions written in the United States. So we're going to look at this expansion of FDA authority today, and we're going to start with Zachary Brennan. He's a senior editor at Endpoints, which covers biotech, drug, pharma, and health news, and he covers the FDA. Zachary, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me.
It's really great to have you. So can you first of all tell us the story of what happened between the court case where the parents won and were still allowed to use this device at that one particular Massachusetts center, and how this language appeared in the omnibus bill in December?
Sure. So there were actually a series of 3 major court cases that the FDA had lost and, you know, lost kind of a series of appeals related to the cases. And they had initially wanted to insert language into what's known as the user fee agreements, which occur every 5 years. And that's basically how the FDA gets paid by industry in order to meet certain deadlines for drug approvals. And so they tried to insert it into that piece of legislation, and Republicans blocked it. And then they, you know, got to the omnibus and, you know, were able to get 2 out of 3 of this reversal language into the omnibus. And yeah, I mean, I think this is just a very unprecedented thing that we don't see typically from the FDA, where they're literally legislatively overturning court losses.
Okay, so then tell me more about specifically what the language in those 19 lines in the omnibus bill say. I mean, how I described it generically, but how much expanded authority does it give FDA?
Well, so this is the thing, right? It's strictly related to device regulation. So and strictly related to the banning of devices. So, you know, I guess you can always kind of make the claim that there's a slippery slope to, you know, therapeutics and drugs and how the FDA regulates off-label use and all of that. But, you know, just based on the language of what's in the omnibus is just related to devices. So anything else is kind of a hypothetical. We'll see what happens in the future.
Okay. So I'm seeing here that, again, a point well taken about this is just about devices. But if I understand correctly, the language in the omnibus bill expands FDA's power to ban medical devices for particular uses if the device poses, quote, an unreasonable or substantial risk of illness or injury. Now, Generally, how does FDA determine those things?
Well, so I think this is kind of a misconception about the FDA, right? The FDA is a data-driven agency run typically by MDs and PhDs. It's not, you know, bureaucratic paper pushers that are, you know, making decisions not based on the literature and not based on the data at hand. So, as you mentioned earlier, you know, there have only been 3 devices or 2 actual devices because they overturned the electrical stimulation one, but 2 other devices, one was powdered gloves and the other one was like prosthetic hair fibers back in the early 80s. So the FDA doesn't typically use this power very frequently. And I think it has, at least in the past, been used in cases where the data are kind of overwhelming. But, you know, they now have this new power. It's unknown what they're going to do with this new power. And it's very different from drugs too, right? We see oftentimes a drug wins an accelerated approval, typically in oncology, and they have to run the confirmatory trial. And if the trial fails or if the trial succeeds, the drug can be pulled from the market very quickly. But doctors can continue to prescribe that drug for that indication, even if it gets pulled. With devices, it's different, right? Once a device gets pulled, it then, as you know, according to lawyers that I've spoken to, it then becomes illegal to use that device. So it is kind of a different way that the FDA regulates devices and drugs in that sense.
Okay. I guess can we just take a quick step back here, Zachary, and help me understand, you know, I think I think a lot of people, and myself included, kind of had these presumptions about how FDA operates and how devices even, you know, make it to market in the first place. Can you kind of just generally describe that process? Because I'm trying to understand how different it is from what then this section in the omnibus purports to, the new power it purports to give to FDA.
Right. So that's the thing. The vast majority of devices that come to market in the U.S. are based on a predicate device and based on the sponsor's ability to show that there's a similarity between the predicate, meaning like the new first time that device came out, and the follow-on that, you know, maybe improves upon that original version in certain ways. So that's typically the vast majority of devices that are coming to market. And, you know, the FDA doesn't even refer to these, you know, so-called approvals as approvals. They refer to them as like a clearance. It's a much simpler process and much less rigorous than, say, a new drug approval or, you know, even an accelerated approval for a new drug.
Mm, okay. But for devices in particular also, I mean, this is something that I think we've talked about on the show before, and that is how much does FDA rely on, say, the pharma companies or the device makers for the data that they use to make their determinations about approval or not. I wonder how much that extends to, you know, even FDA funding, because I understand that device makers actually are important parts of FDA's funding.
They are indeed. And I think the FDA does very much rely on both the pharmaceutical and the medical device industries to provide them with adequate information. You know, the FDA doesn't have people like sitting around combing through databases of EHRs looking for, you know, adverse events of medical devices, that sort of thing. So they're very much reliant on, you know, companies stepping forward and, you know, and that's what the regulations kind of mandate that the companies have to do, you know, report X number of adverse events.
Well, Zachary Brennan, stand by here for just a moment. Zachary is the senior editor at Endpoints News, and we'll have more in a second. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about a couple of lines that were tucked into the massive $1.7 trillion omnibus spending bill that was passed in December. And these few lines expand the FDA's authority to ban off-label use of certain medical devices for certain practices. It's a new and interesting expansion of FDA's power, and we're trying to understand the pros and cons of it this hour. I'm joined today by Zachary Brennan. He's senior editor at Endpoints News, where he covers FDA. And I'd like to bring Dr. Randall Stafford into the conversation now. He's a professor of medicine at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Stafford, welcome to you.
Good to be here.
I'd like to actually ask you if you could first describe to us how anything gets used off-label to begin with. How common is the practice?
Well, the practice is very common both for devices as well as drugs. And essentially, an off-label use is a use of a device or drug for a particular clinical situation or indication that has not been scrutinized by the FDA in its clearance or approval process. And off-label use arises for a vast range of situations. There are situations in which a generic drug, for instance, may find new uses. And in that case, there's little incentive for the generic manufacturers to seek expanded approval or supplemental approval of a new indication for that drug. There are certainly cases where clinicians have utilized all existing remedies that are on label and are searching for ways to treat their patients outside of the usual indications approved by the FDA. Essentially, the FDA-approved indications no longer work, and there's a certain type of innovation, essentially looking for a remedy to help patients.
Okay. So just to be clear, let's also get some definitions down. When we talk about off-label, we are literally meaning uses that are not explicitly on the label that would come with a device or a prescription drug. Is that right, Dr. Stafford?
That's correct. And the best way to understand the word label is to associate that with the package insert that comes with any drug prescription.
Okay. So again, to refocus on what Congress has done, they have expanded FDA's or authorized FDA to be able to stop certain off-label uses of medical devices. We're going to get to the concern about prescription drugs in a few minutes. But on a normal basis for devices, is it similar to what you said about prescription drugs that doctors may say, well, we've tried everything else, let's try this device for whatever condition their patient might present with. And doing so is totally legal, even though that's not what the device was approved for by FDA.
That's exactly right. And let me give you one example of a particular device whose use did rise in terms of off-label use. There's a particular stent that is actually manufactured for use in cancer of the bile system near the liver. This is a device that's meant to be palliative, that is, there's no sense in which this is curing a cancer, but it's allowing patients to continue to live and in some sense saving their liver from the usual consequences of the cancer. It was found that this device, this stent, which essentially is a wire mesh that keeps open a blood vessel or a bile duct, could be used in renal artery stenosis. And there was a time when use of this device off-label was very frequently used for the process of opening up a patient's renal artery to try to reverse a problem of kidney failure.
I see. So there's a physician or a researcher out there that said, let's try this. They have this innovative idea. I'm going to presume for a moment that there was adequate consent amongst the medical team and patients, and it works, and then the practice spreads. But Zachary Brennan, let me turn back to you then. If these are not, sticking with the stent and renal artery example, if that's not the approved FDA usage of that particular kind of stent, then where does the oversight take place for these new uses?
So, for any device that the manufacturer has to report any sort of adverse events related to that device, no matter how they're used, and the doctor also has to report that to either the manufacturer or to the FDA as well. So it's not as if there's like a gray area where, if there's some sort of side effect that isn't going reported. But yeah, I mean, as to your point, like the FDA doesn't control, certainly for drugs, they don't control off-label use in any sense. And that's kind of their mandate is safety and efficacy first. And they're not really trying to tell physicians how to use drugs or devices other than what's in the labeling, as Randall mentioned.
Okay, safety and efficacy first being the mandate for FDA. Dr. Stafford, about that renal stent that you offered as an example, was it effective?
Following the rise of its use, several studies came out suggesting that it was not effective. And those clinical trials really changed practice enormously over the last decade. The stenting is still a valuable process in some instances, but has largely been abandoned for a particular type of narrowing of the arteries for the kidney.
Okay. So in that case, then, would the example of this off-label use of the stent be an argument for the expanded authority that Congress has given FDA? Dr. Stafford.
I think it is a particularly potent example of how the marketplace will expand use of a particular device or drug, even in the absence of good information. Now, in this case, there's a certain logic to its use in renal artery stenosis, that is the narrowing of the arteries serving the kidneys. But the actual clinical trials didn't substantiate that presumption. And so we had a period of time when this device was being used for indications that weren't particularly effective. But I will say that part of the story here is that there has been adjustment to clinical practices. And, you know, this is an area of very high-tech medicine. My belief is that most practitioners pay attention to the literature, and there has been a response of reduction in use of the renal artery stenting.
Okay. So what I'm trying to understand, though, again, is why this language ended up, why this expanded authority ended up in that omnibus bill. I'm trying to understand what the perceived need for it is, because, you know, Zachary Brennan, you had told us earlier that FDA has only gone so far as to ban medical devices three times in the past, right? I got that number right. It's just barely three times.
Yes.
Okay. And so in that case, even with, let's say, again, the example that Dr. Stafford gave us of the renal stent is quite an arresting one. When there is evidence of either unsafe off-label use of a device or ineffective off-label use of a device, FDA still does not step in, it sounds like, often, a lot of the time. So what's the point of the expanded language?
Well, I think the point is more in some of these like very egregious cases where it's much more black and white in terms of the device being effective or safe. I don't know. I mean, I guess on the drug side, we see a lot of drugs that kind of, you know, will fail in a confirmatory trial or, you know, not hit their primary endpoint, but still show some efficacy in some of the patients in the trial. And the FDA will still pull that indication. But that isn't to say that, you know, it didn't help anyone in the trial. So I don't know. I think there are a lot of unknowns with what they're going to do with this power. But I think that honestly, they were, you know, upset about what the court had initially said in terms of not being able to ban specific uses and only being able to ban entire devices. And, you know, obviously they thought they needed a little bit more leeway and Congress was happy to help in this instance. But we'll see, you know, we'll see what courts say in the future as well.
Okay, so it's the unknowns, I think, that are giving many in the medical community a cause for concern. So I want to bring in another voice into the conversation. Brad Thompson is with us. He's an attorney at the law firm Epstein Becker Green, where he counsels medical device and drug product companies on FDA regulatory issues and practice. Brad Thompson, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay, so Zachary Brennan tells us FDA barely uses its power already to interfere with devices once they're on the market. But you represent, a device manufacturers who are quite concerned about what Congress has done. Why?
Well, I don't think FDA asked for the power because they didn't intend to use it. They asked for it because they wanted it and they wanted to make use of it. And it is unprecedented. It upsets the balance between federal regulation of interstate commerce, which is the basis for FDA's jurisdiction, drugs and medical devices and food for that matter, that pass in interstate commerce. That's how FDA gets its power. but all powers not given to the federal government are reserved to the states, according to the Bill of Rights, the 10th Amendment. And that's an important design of our system of government. We want the states, we want local governments to govern wherever it makes sense. And the regulation of medicine, the practice of medicine, has for hundreds of years been done at the state level. And that's because these are complicated issues, and it's better to deal with them locally, where it can be a more sort of tailored evaluation. We're in this mode of personalized medicine where we're realizing just how different people react to different treatments. And to put it mildly, medicine is complicated. And so we avoid the centralized oversight of the federal government deciding what is right and what is wrong, and we leave it to the states. That's the way it's always been. And in my opinion, that's the way it should remain.
Let me ask for clarification here. When you say the regulation of the practice of medicine has always been done at the state level, mm-hmm. one obvious example of that is board certification, for example.
Yep.
Are there other examples? Because I'm
so
just,
really, it's two pronged, right? It's the boards of medicine, which not only initially license doctors, but can de-license doctors. They can take their license away. They can discipline them. They have really extraordinary power over what doctors do individually. And then it's malpractice law. It's the plaintiff's lawyers who hold doctors accountable under state law if they mistreat a patient.
Okay. So you're saying that this is a unnecessary overreach of federal authority. But at the same time, I mean, we're living in a world right now where we have device makers, definitely pharma companies, that are selling in all 50 states. So is there not the need for some kind and some kind of centralization, for lack of a better term, of data, information, and oversight for those companies that are actually operating in every state in the union?
But we have that, right? That's what FDA does. It regulates the device, and it regulates what the seller of the device can say in promoting the device and the manner in which they promote it. It's not just limited to the labeling, but it's limited to actually how they go about promoting it, what meetings they go to, and so forth. So you have that federal oversight that controls that central mechanism for selling the product. But then it's a whole different step to say we're going to regulate the users of those products and the decisions they make about how best to use those products.
Okay. Dr. Randall Stafford, how do you respond to that?
So I want to go back to something Zachary had said, which essentially has to do with expectations that are placed on the FDA. The FDA is really in a difficult place because the public truly does have an expectation that the FDA is making sure that devices and drugs are safe and effective. And yet, as was mentioned, there is a legislative requirement that prohibits the FDA from the practice of medicine. So I think some of this has to go back to how we navigate the policy issues around what the public expects of the FDA and what the FDA actually does in real fact.
Wait, so Dr. Stafford, wait, can you clarify that again? Because I want to be sure I heard that correctly. So there is a prohibition against FDA interfering with the practice of medicine. Yes, you said that?
Yes, that's very correct.
So then doesn't that fly in the face of this additional authority given to it by Congress in the omnibus bill to ban devices for specific uses?
Well, despite that oft-repeated mantra about the FDA not practicing medicine, it's very clear that to fulfill the public expectation of the FDA would require just that sort of action. And certainly the FDA in regulating advertising and promotion, in some sense is telling physicians that there are certain facts and certain information that the drug companies or device manufacturers should not be passing along to them. So I think that this is an issue of trying to balance what the public expects of the FDA with what the FDA actually can do. And I would argue that given some of the more egregious cases of off-label device and drug use, then in some sense, this more specific banning of devices is likely in keeping with what the public expects of the FDA. Now, of course, one of the issues here is that the public and even physicians in the case of drugs don't often recognize when they're using a drug off-label.
Right. So, Dr. Stafford, hang in here for just a second because now we're getting to the issue of the doctor-patient relationship as well. And I want to talk a lot more about that with all of you when we come back from a quick break. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I want to give you a heads up about something we're working on for next week. We are going to be talking about the Colorado River and major water issues in the western United States. Because, of course, the Colorado being the literal lifeblood for many western states. And there's a compact, the Colorado River Water Compact, that allows states to figure out how they're going to use the water. The problem is, of course, there's less and less water every single year. And now the states, primarily California, cannot agree on how to apportion the water among seven western states. So we want to hear from you. If you depend on the Colorado River for your water, whether it's urban, rural, or agricultural use, we want to hear from you. How concerned are you about the future of water in your state? Are you taking measures to conserve water in your community? What's the conversation like where you live about the uses of water in the western United States? So go pick up your phone and get the On Point Vox Pop app. If you don't already have it, you can go to wherever you get your apps and look for On Point Vox Pop and send us your thoughts that way. You can also leave us a regular voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We want to hear from our listeners in the western United States about the Colorado River and the reality of less water as every year goes by. Okay, so that's for next week. Today, we are talking about a really interesting provision, a couple of lines in the December $1.7 trillion omnibus bill that expands FDA's authority to ban off-label uses of certain medical devices. It's actually quite an unprecedented move. Now, we did contact FDA and requested an interview. They declined, but instead the Food and Drug Administration sent us this statement, which is, quote, "The FDA is reviewing the provisions in the omnibus legislation enacted in December and evaluating their impact with regard to oversight of these devices," end quote. Okay. Brad Thompson, let me turn back to you. You know, we're already here. You talked about the states' rights argument. But we're also already hearing concerns from certain parts of the medical community about something even more sort of intimate and immediate in the lives of patients, that there are doctors that are concerned this could really just interfere with the doctor-patient relationship. What do you think about that?
I think that's an important point. And if I can go back for just a moment to something that Dr. Stafford said, he said that there's an expectation among consumers that FDA has blessed, and I don't remember, I don't want to put words in Dr. Stafford's mouth, but blessed something. I think that's a factual observation and it needs data. And I don't think we have data on this phone call to evaluate it. I would say that what patients expect is products that are labeled correctly based on evidence and that are safe and effective for their labeled use. I don't think patients expect that every word out of their physician's mouth has been FDA approved or every decision their physician makes is an FDA approved decision. I don't think that's the nature of the relationship. And the more we move in that direction, the more we act as though FDA is responsible for what a doctor says, it does destroy that doctor-patient relationship because we turn to doctors based on their education, based on their knowledge of us individually as patients, and their caring about our health. And all of that gets eroded if all of a sudden it becomes a matter of federal regulation. Mm.
Dr. Stafford, would you like to respond?
Well, I think that there is a real value in allowing off-label use, particularly when it leads to innovation in the setting where approved therapies have failed. However, I think if we look historically at patterns of use of drugs, there are situations in which off-label uses become a first-line treatment. And as I said previously, there is evidence that neither patients nor even the doctors necessarily are aware of what is or isn't a off-label use. So, you know, going back to a time when there was great increase in the use of antipsychotic medications, you know, my colleagues and I found that several of these antipsychotic medications were being used in such a way that three quarters of their use, you know, essentially multiple millions of uses, were being used off-label without good evidence. Mm-hmm. And the cost of these treatments was up in the range of $2 billion per year. So to say that doctors are using off-label only in certain situations, I think is to misunderstand the nature of how drugs and devices disseminate within the system and the extent to which profit is driving many of the patterns of medical practice.
Right. Continued use even in the absence of evidence of its efficacy, as in the renal stent example that you gave us a little earlier, Dr. Stafford. But so this is the point at which I think...
Am I allowed to respond to that? Or sorry to interrupt, but it's hard for me to leave that unchallenged.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. It's, you know, certainly there are cases where something becomes a popular use, but that's never the product of just individual doctor decision making. There's at least two layers that typically come into play. One is the institution at which the doctor practices, that when they start seeing the growth of an area, they decide, they have their own medical policies and so forth, they decide what is the standard of care at that institution. And then payers, who have a very significant interest in all this because they're shelling out big bucks for this stuff, need to look at this and develop a coverage policy to decide whether the evidence is adequate for them to pay for the use of that product. So it's not some, you know, individual doctor just going off on a whim. We have an elaborate healthcare system that looks at those things quite apart from what federal regulators do.
Mm, okay. Dr. Stafford, I'm going to allow you to respond. And then there's some couple other important issues I'd like to move toward. So go ahead.
Yeah, I essentially agree that there are multiple layers of regulation and of recommended practices which help define what individual physicians are doing. One thing that's important to recognize, however, is that our medical malpractice system is really based on the idea of community practice. And a physician's practice is allowed and is only really subject to comparison with the community. It's never in comparison with the evidence available.
Okay, so this is why I want. This is actually a really great way to return to, for a moment, the case that led to to Congress expanding FDA's authority late last year. Because if I understand it correctly, the use of this particular, you know, electric shock device at the Judge Rotenberg Center, the problem wasn't that it wasn't effective in any case. We heard from some parents who said it worked for their kids. It's that it was how it was used with some other kids that protesters and other parents severely objected to. Now, the reason why I point that out is because it doesn't sound necessarily like the device was the problem, but its use. Right? So Zachary Brennan, let me pull you back in here. When we are really what we're debating is how a device is used, this is why I think some people, or perhaps many people in the medical community, do raise alarm bells, because they see Congress is giving the FDA this additional authority as that crack in the door that could open up sort of more federal interference in the uses of other aspects of medicine, prescription drugs, maybe down the line. Now, we already are living in a world where certain prescription drugs are under political pressure. You know, there are common drugs used for helping women who are suffering miscarriages that are also help women who are seeking medical abortions. Those drugs are in the courts right now. So do you see how there is concern amongst lots of physicians and maybe even patients out there that that we're at the tip of this slippery slope, Zachary?
Yeah, certainly. You know, to Brad's point, I think this really is unprecedented to see, you know, this additional power added to FDA's, defenses. But yeah, I mean, it's just really hard to say, as both Dr. Stafford and Brad mentioned, like there are so many devices out there with so many off-label uses. How does FDA, does CDRH, the division within FDA that regulates devices, which is historically underfunded and historically well-funded by industry, do they have the manpower to really start going after, lots of devices that are going to really impact the way physicians treat patients? What I don't know. We don't know. But there is a well-worn process, and I think we saw this play out with the Covis preterm birth drug Machina recently, where the FDA says you have to pull this drug. The data don't match what we initially authorized it for, and the company says no. And they take it to a hearing and they get to both present their sides. And there's a very, rigid process by which both sides get to lay out their claims, and then the FDA commissioner makes a decision. So, it's not as if the FDA just one day wakes up and says, we're going to start banning all these devices. Like, there's a process to this.
Mm. Well, Dr. Stafford, I'd love to hear what you have to say about this concern that, again, as I mentioned, the door may be opened to FDA also then, even with what Zachary said in mind, start taking a closer look at prescription drugs.
Well, I think that it is a little bit speculative to say that the FDA will necessarily apply this to drugs, but I think it is a concern. And again, I think what we are talking about here is how to balance a ecosystem where there's clearly a profit motive for marketing drugs and for getting those drugs used, whether for on-label or off-label use. We have the FDA underfunded and under-resourced to do a job that the public expects. And of course, in some ways, consumers are misunderstanding what the FDA actually has to do. I think that this example is one where the FDA feels that it can better serve the public through a ban that is not total. And one can think of historical examples where particular drugs have been taken off the market where their use actually was quite useful. One example might be Vioxx or Rosuvastatin, which was banned in the aughts. And this drug, I think, was useful to a large number of people, but at that point, the FDA didn't have any other alternative but to ban it entirely from the market. So I very much support the idea that the FDA may need new tools, and this is a new tool. And yet, as Zachary says, I think any movement forward is going to be careful. And as the case with the banning of the electrical stimulation devices, there's a careful process that the FDA and the manufacturer go through.
Mm. Again, it just makes me wonder then if such a process is in place both at FDA and then, as Brad Thompson was saying, vis-a-vis how the market works. Why did Congress take this step? But Brad Thompson, you know, there's something that's been mentioned a couple of times, which I do want to ask you about. And that is, you can also read the objection of device manufacturers, many of whom you work with and represent, as quite simply an objection because you want to continue to sell in all 50 states. And that any move by FDA to say, no, a device cannot be used for, you know, this certain treatment, the primary problem that makers have is because, you know, it will prevent them from selling, that it's a business concern that's there, really, perhaps even more than a doctor-patient relationship concern.
You know, I think one thing that we probably all ought to agree on is that FDA has very strong control over the manufacturers and how they promote these products. They have the power during the approval process to define exactly what the label can say, what is on label. And then through their enforcement mechanisms, they have the ability to control really anything and everything that the manufacturer does in order to promote the product. And some of the biggest fines paid by drug and device companies have been for when they mess up and they promote something for an off-label use. There are literally hundreds of cases of such enforcement, and the companies have to pay massive fines. So there really is no freedom here on behalf of the companies when it comes to these off-label uses. The only issue is how folks can who buy them can use them.
Mm. Well, you know, in conclusion, what I'm hearing from all of you is that there's still many unknowns, right, about what FDA is going to do with this additional power. And again, in FDA's own statement, they say they're reviewing it right now. So we don't know what's going to happen. But I consider this hour one in which we're just alerting our listeners, the public, to the fact that there is this quiet but unprecedented change that's working its way through an important regulatory agency in this country. And we'll keep tabs on it to see what FDA does decide to do as time goes by. So with that, I'd like to thank all of you. Brad Thompson, attorney at law at the law firm Epstein Becker Green. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Randall Stafford, professor of medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Stafford, thank you as well.
Good to be here.
And Zachary Brennan, senior editor at Endpoints News, where he covers the FDA. Zachary, it's been great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks again.
All right. Well, that's it for today. But again, I want to give folks a reminder of something we're working on for next week about the Colorado River and the diminishing supply of water there. So if you live in a western state that relies on the Colorado for its water, for urban use, for ranching use, for ag use, we want to hear from you. What changes have you been seeing in your water supply? Are you concerned about the future of the Colorado River water? And how do you think seven states ought to apportion their water? Does that Colorado River Compact work for you? Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Or get the On Point Vox Pop app on your phone and send us a message that way. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.